Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, August 10th, 2006. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, sadly, we see the end of the interviews recorded at the National Homebrewers Conference in Orlando. You know, I have to admit that I felt spoiled having easy access to all the experts down there in person without having to line up telephone interviews. In this episode, we have the privilege of talking to two great American craft brewers about a subject near and dear to our hearts, hops. We sat with Matt Brindelson of Firestone Walker Brewing Company. Matt and Firestone Walker were named Champion Brewery and Brewmaster of the Mid-Sized Brewer category of the World Beer Cup this year. So sitting alongside Matt was John Mallett of Bell's Brewing Company. You know, John is no slouch himself. Bell's is known for their wonderful Two-Hearted Ale, Bell's Oberon, the Bell's Wheat Project, and other tasty, tasty brews. We talked to these talented guys about dry hopping. How do they get those outstanding hop aromas? More importantly, how do we get them in our home brews? Their tips may change the way you brew. Also, we talked to them about first wort hopping, which is a technique that is just gaining a foothold in this country. Well, speaking of first wort hopping, I got a note from Jeff in England, who is a big fan of the technique. If you haven't heard of it, it's essentially adding hops to the wort before the boil. Some add hops to the brew pot as they're collecting their wort from the mash. Others even hop in the mash tun. Now, I asked Jeff what he sees as the benefits of first wort hopping, and he says, "Don't know how to describe it, except that maybe it gives a more harmonious hop character, round bitterness, and flavor depth." I haven't done side-by-side experiments, Jeff says, but it has become standard operating procedure on my beers, as I've found I prefer the beers done with first wort hopping. I use low alpha hops, Fuggles, Goldings, Hollertau, Styrian Goldings, and take 2 to 3 times what I would normally use on a flavor addition and lessen my usual bittering addition. Some batches, my first wort hops are the only bittering hop added. And Jeff says, the other big plus, no more boilovers. I run my kettle to 1 inch from the brim and have never had a boilover, something about the surface area of all the whole hops. Well, very interesting. You know, Jeff suggests that we do some experimenting with the process here, as we did with late hopping, and I think that's a great idea. I'm interested in hearing others' experiences with first wort hopping, too, so if you've played with it, let me know. You may remember that in the past show I said that I'd heard from listeners on every continent except Antarctica. Well, John from Australia wrote with a couple of web links that show that homebrewing does in fact happen near the South Pole. John even sent me a clipping from a list of regulations for New Zealand Antarctic personnel for homebrewing. Now, this is listed as procedure number one. And it's dated June 2004, and it's titled Production of Homebrew Beer and Distillation of Spirits. The objective of this procedure is to facilitate the making of homebrew by those who wish to carry out this activity and to ensure that the making of the product is controlled to an acceptable level. Number one, the making of homebrew will be permitted under controlled conditions during the winter season only. It's a long winter down there, so I guess they got to get some homebrew to help them make it through it. Number two, those wishing to operate homebrew kits at Scott Base must make application to the winter manager, who will advise Antarctica, New Zealand of any approvals given. Number three, the winter manager is to be made aware of any brews underway and their location at Scott Base. Number four, The setting up of a brew in any area shall not impede the normal operations of that area. Well, that makes sense. Number five, the stored product shall not exceed an acceptable level. This level will be determined by the winter manager. So it would behoove you to get in good with the winter manager. Number six, any brews made at Scott Base are for local consumption and are not to be exported from Antarctica. So, doggone it, You know, I was hoping to get some home brews from Antarctica, but I don't think that's going to happen. And number seven, distillation of spirits and liqueurs is not permitted at any time. So thank you. Thank you very much. Home brewing on the continent of Antarctica. You know, it'd be fun to be down there for a few minutes. I'm sure it gets cold down there. Thanks to John for finding that on the web for us. Brian in Marquette, Michigan, saw our video podcast on pairing beer with dessert, which is out this week, and he writes, "My wife and I just made a dinner last night, and we used two different beers as ingredients. We sautéed some onions and portobello mushrooms with some Rausch beer, or smoked beer, to serve with our steaks. They turned out great. The smokiness from the beer went well with the steak." Boy, it does sound good. "We also made some asparagus, but instead of steaming them with water, I used a Delirium Tremens clone that I made a few months back. It gave the asparagus a nice sweetness." Well, that sounds delicious. And I tell you, after talking to Randy Mosher about pairing beer with food, it certainly opened my eyes to more possibilities for my favorite beverage. And, you know, going along those lines, Matt from Lewiston, Maine writes, "Do you know where I could get homebrew recipes for people who don't like beer? My fiance hates beer and refuses to drink it. She's barely tolerant of my homebrewing hobby. I was hoping to find a way to spark her interest so I don't need to schedule my homebrewing at times when she's at work. She doesn't even like wine, so that won't work either. Any ideas would be great." Well, I think this food pairing thing may be a tactic that you can sort of use to nudge your fiancé toward looking at beer in another light. I think if she could try the ginger peach ale float that Steve made on that video podcast, she might like it. I don't know. All he did was he took some peach ginger beer and put a dollop of vanilla ice cream in it and a slice of peach on top. It was wonderful. We were scared that we would hate it, but we didn't. It was great. So I don't know. This is a tricky question, and one that I think we may have looked at on this podcast in the past, but I think it's worth another look. So if you have any suggestions for Matt on beers that would be good gateway beers for his fiance, drop us a line, let us know. Or if you have a success story of turning a significant other around as far as their opinions on good beers, let us know. You can email james@basicbrewing.com or use the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. I spent some time the other night with the guys from Big Foamy Head for an upcoming show of theirs. We talked about homebrew and hops. It was a fun conversation, so look for that on bigfoamyhead.com. Also, I got my Craft Beer Radio commemorative anniversary DVD in the mail yesterday. I'm looking forward to digging into the bonus content on that. And you can find out how you can get your copy and support CBR at the same time at craftbeerradio.com. A very worthy cause. Philip from Atlanta wrote in with a clarification from last week's show. In talking about Britannomyces, Raj Apte said this.
We have to remember Britannomyces means English yeast, because it's from Brittany, right? That's the Britannomyces. The Britann is from Brittany.
Philip points out that Brittany is not in Britain, but actually a part of France. And Philip suggests that neither group of people would appreciate being labeled as the other. That's probably a good point. Thanks, Philip. And here I thought Brittany was a pregnant pop star. Raj wasn't the only one ruffling international feathers this past show. ALX from Montreal wrote in to point out that I left Canada out of the list of countries and regions that have easy access to homebrew equipment and supplies. So my apologies to our neighbors to the north and to anyone else that I should have included in that list. You know, I should know better. Anytime you make a list, you're going to leave somebody out. So my apologies to our friendly neighbors in Canada up to the north. Well, that's enough of me talking. I better quit before I offend another whole country. Let's get on to our conversation with Matt Brendelson of Firestone Walker and John Mallett of Bell's. Matt gave a presentation on the eternal quest for the ultimate hop impact. That was the name of his session. When I asked him to talk to me about his presentation, John Mallett was standing close by, so I nabbed them both. And we went out onto the somewhat noisy porch of the conference center there to talk about hops.
All right, John and Matt, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio. And we're out here on the veranda. So, you know, in typical southern fashion, we're out in the rocking chairs and the wicker, and all we're missing is a juleps to make it complete. I want to talk to you guys about hops. And Matt, you gave the presentation, and John, you just happened to be standing dangerously close, so I nabbed you as well. But I want to specifically talk about early hopping or first wort hopping and dry hopping, so on either side of the boil. So start us off, Matt, by talking about the concept of first wort hopping and how would you accomplish it?
Well, first wort hopping is adding hops either into the grant or adding them immediately after runoff is initiated. So these are hops that are in contact with wort for however long it takes to run a batch off to the kettle, and then also continue on with the brew throughout the boil and the clarification stages. So it results in very long contact times with those hops. And the research or what papers, and there's not a lot of stuff out there on this from a real technical standpoint, would suggest is that somehow a favorable hop impact was a result. Some claim a milder bitterness and more humulene or noble hop characteristic. But the trials that are out there stated that the beers that were done in this way compared to the conventional hopping were preferred by the panels. Now, this was done in German Pilsner beer and now is being applied to
small scale.
Craft brewers batches. There we go.
Although it could be applied to stale batches as well.
German beer being what it is.
Well,
it takes a while to get it over here. I mean, I used to think trans-2-nonenol, you know, so the classic cardboard stale character that was always identified with, you know, my early beer tasting experience was, hey, that's that German taste. You know, all these German beers have this flavor. And, you know, you go over to Germany and they didn't have that German flavor anymore.
Only for the American market.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of characteristics does this first wort hopping give to the beer?
Well, now, I haven't done the analytical work, but it suggests that it's heavy oil character or noble hop character, and that's typically associated with the humulene epoxides and this sesquiterpene oils, not the characteristic that we're getting from dry hopping. However, I think the people that first read that literature, they heard hoppy and hoppy notes and aroma and flavor, and they may have assumed that it was fresh hop character, but it's something completely different, in my opinion.
Is this a concept that you guys would are interested in exploring?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has some interest, but you know, in talking to, you know, we're pretty happy with what you know we're doing right now in terms of the ability to get hoppy characters into our beers. And from talking to other brewers who have played with this a little more extensively, it's very much my impression that you know, sort of there's a hoppy character that you get from, you know, beta acid oxidation, you know, this breakdown characters that is so different than the really fresh, you know, sort of high notes, the citrusy sort of characteristics. And I think that what you're doing in some ways by doing that, by having a very long contact time, is you are perhaps enhancing some of that oxidative capacity by holding it for long periods of time. I sort of think of often, you know, sort of German noble hops as being fundamentally about degradation of those beta acids, more so than, you know, the fresh, either very aromatic, citrusy kind of characteristics, and of course very different entirely than just straight bitterness in a hop.
And also, did you say that that these characteristics might be masked by some of the, you know, the stronger American beers that we're experiencing nowadays?
Right. It seemed like the styles that this type of hopping fit best were lighter beers that weren't dry hopped, lighter beers where subtleties would come through and be apparent.
Now, in a homebrew environment, the hops would just be added. Oh, and you were talking, how much of the hop volume would be added to the brew pot as you're essentially filling it?
You know, just after leaving the talk, you know, I was probably approached by a half dozen people on the subject, and it sounds like some of the homebrewers have more experience with this than, you know, myself at least. But once again, the literature suggested 30% of the hop charge that was going to be added to the kettle and leaving the rest of the recipe the same. Now, I don't recall the exact numbers. It would lead you to believe that you'd end up with a little more utilization and possibly more bitterness in the finished product. But again, the panel selected those beers as preferred over the conventionally hopped version. And some of the people that I talked to after just recently here at the conference suggested they got a softer bitterness from first wort hopped beer on the homebrew scale. So, you know, I think that's left to be known for sure.
Let's move on to a topic that you guys definitely know more about, and that's dry hopping. And keep in mind that, you know, we're talking to a homebrew audience. First of all, preference between whole hop and pellets?
Personally, my preference is for pellets. I think that, you know, my job as a professional brewer is to attempt to consistently produce the product time and time again. And I think that the stability of the package in pellets is just far superior. And I don't want to make a hop beer that is, you know, this is our hoppy beer for January, this is our hoppy beer for August. I want to be able to settle into something so when somebody buys my product, they know that what they're pretty much going to get. And for that reason, I think that the dry hopping with pellets is preferred for me. Another real advantage is, you know, just the sort of storageability, inside of our plant and handling. When we're dry hopping, we're putting in excess of 200 pounds. We're handling in excess of 200 pounds, and trying to get that into beer, you know, to dissolve, you know, just to be in the beer, to get in contact with the beer, not to float on top of the beer, not to float down through the beer and settle in a solid mass. It's a proposition. So we've found that we've had by far the best results with dry hopping with pellets.
Matt?
I tend to agree. I mean, I always preface this that by, you know, Sierra Nevada is one of the pioneers in some of this dry hop beer, especially on the commercial level. And they did it with whole leaf and have done it with whole leaf. So great beers are made with whole leaf. But I agree with John that just, you know, from a practical standpoint, pellets are much easier to handle. From a year-round consistency, they're superior in that way. And the fact that it's ground material, ruptured lupulin gland, there's surface area there. There's a quicker release of what you're looking for into the product. And in modern vertically oriented cylinder conical fermenters, it's super easy to handle. You put it in the top, it comes out the bottom, clear beer comes out after. And I think that same thing applies on the homebrew level. I think that it's probably easier and a higher yielding process than using whole leaf. Now, there's different characteristics, and the little I played with whole leaf, there is something different there than pellets. So, you know, there's a level of subjectivity to this. I mean, there are brewers who want that whole leaf character. They want a little more of that vegetative, herbal, however else you want to describe it, character. But in the end, I prefer pellets, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, for us, we use a lot of Centennial and dry hop in our beers, and I think that, you know, for those styles, that really works well. That being said, I've also made significant amount of beer using much more herbaceous kind of beer, using say East Kent Goldings, trying to get those in there. And again, it seemed like I got with those beers, we were able to get more of a sort of green character to it than with the pellets.
And then, you know, going back to a little bit on that first wort hopping, I think if you're going to do mash hopping, especially, or anything that's going to end up in the lager tun, whole leaf is the way to go, absolutely. And I kind of consider mash hopping just another form of first wort hopping. hop back activity or filtering wort, whole leaf works great. You go to whirlpool and dry hop, pellets seem to work so much better, at least at the scale that we're operating at. And I experienced the same thing when I was homebrewing as well.
I like to call whole hops hop sponges, yeah, because of the amount of beer that they soak up it seems like to me that at least in the boiling, the pellets were a lot easier to handle as well. I can't imagine brewing on the scale that you guys do and doing that with whole hops.
Well, it's interesting, you know. When you know, one of the things Matt and I like to do is we'll travel all over the world. We travel all the world together, and with the various other brewers, and go and look at breweries. And you know, truly, one of the most impressive sort of commitments to quality that you see is, you know, in Anheuser-Busch. Now, I don't drink a lot of yellow beer. I do think Anheuser-Busch has just some of the best brewers out there. You know, they've got technical resources that are just wild. They made that commitment to go to whole leaf, and you know, they're now starting to go into pellets. I think last year they started to do that. But you look at handling hops on that scale and the sort of specialized equipment that they have and that commitment, you know that somewhere there was a bean counter saying, you know, we could save a lot of money if we did it this way. Very impressive to me. Had a lot of good, you know, very, very interesting approach.
It'll be interesting to go now, you know, mark time and then go 10 years in the future, and if someone like AB does go to pellets.
Well, they've started now.
Right, and how the rest of the world might follow, or, you know, 10 years from now, how many large brewers are really going to bother with handling whole leaf, or if they've finally decided, because so much of this also is tradition, and so much of it is, you know, brewmaster before me said whole leaf is the way we do it, and the family says that's the recipe, and that's what we're doing, and opening our eyes to new approaches as well.
Now let's talk about timing on dry hopping. Most of the stuff that I've read is dry hop in the secondary. You know, that way you have less chance of infection or contamination. And from your slide presentation, Matt, you seem to disagree.
Yeah, and a lot of this isn't just coming from myself. This is, you know, I did the survey and called around to a lot of other award-winning craft brewers, and it turned out that most of them were doing it, you know, it's more like between primary and secondary. Few were adding hops during an active, full active fermentation, but very shortly thereafter. And mind you, most of this is happening in cylindroconical unitank fermentation where, you know, secondary is happening in the same vessel, but it's happening on the warm side. That's what most brewers are doing. And we look at it, and a lot of these other brewers look at it from just like all chemical reactions. If you're looking to do, what we're trying to do is we're trying to extract flavor and oil and character out of the hops that's going to happen faster at warm temperatures. It's going to happen more readily at warm temperatures. So, you know, there's great beers that are probably made, I shouldn't say probably, there are great beers made with secondary dry hopping on the cold side, but they sit on the hops longer, and I think they tend to have more of that herbal kind of vegetative, herbaceous character to them.
John?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, for us, what we like to see is we like to see the fermentation up and down. You know, we like a good, strong ferment, and as soon as that starts to calm down, I want to get those hops in there. I want to get them in there while I still have some fermentation going on in the tank. There's some movement in that tank. There's some turnover. If there's any oxygen that's incorporated in there, it's very quickly scavenged with that yeast. I've got a warm condition for it to sit in. And then, you know, we'll start to probably leave it on there for most of a week or so and then move it into a different tank. And for us, the process works really well. You know, we end up with, you know, startlingly clear beer for a brewery that doesn't filter. You know, oftentimes I'm at the pub and one of the regulars will walk up with a glass of beer and say, like, when'd you guys start filtering? And it's impressive that, you know, especially with those racked dry hop beers, just how much clearer they are as well.
Do all of your patrons talk like that?
I reckon. No. No, usually you're talking to falsetto.
Now, what about the risk of contamination?
Well, you know, there's a lot of non-pasteurizing, non-sterile filtering craft brewers that are packaging very stable beer that's dry hop. So, I mean, I think it's been proven that microbiologically speaking, if sanitary technique is carried out in the brewery, the dry hops themselves are not carrying or harboring any beer-spoiling organisms. We have yet to find any, and we plate the hop material before and the beer after dry hopping and haven't found anything. Like I was talking about in the talk, Enterobacter and Bacillus is found in most agricultural products that haven't been heat treated or otherwise sanitized. So these are organisms that aren't beer spoilers. So we see them come up early on from time to time in these batches that have been dry hopped, but the organism dies out very quickly and is just it's just too inhospitable of an environment for those organisms.
Yeah, I mean, looking at our, you know, with our lab reports, you know, we're constantly looking at pitching yeast and beer. You know, we think we look at it 3 days, 7 days, 2 weeks, and bottle. And you know, consistently, it's you know, oh yeah, the dry hop beer has that dry hop, wort spoiler in it. I do think it's important. You know, I sort of thinking about earlier hopping in the kettle, and then thinking, well, maybe we could, you know, hop right into fermenter, and that would be the warmest and the most active and all. I would be very cautious of that. I mean, wort is an incredibly rich nutrient. Until it goes through its pH drop, until it starts building up alcohol, and still until it starts building up CO2, it's really going to harbor a lot of stuff. And so, you know, sort of, I guess the logical thing would be to say, well, we should just dry hop right at cool in, and then we'll have the best of all. But I think that would be pretty great potential for making some increasing wort spoilers in there to an unacceptable level.
Now, what about strategies on picking hop varieties and determining the amount of hops to dry hop with on the homebrew scale? I mean, we can read Ray Daniel's book and figure out IBUs. You know, we can look at the alpha acid content of hops and figure out, you know, like I say, IBUs with a mathematical formula. Is there a correlation to the amount of aroma and hop flavor that you get out of dry hopping?
That's a tough one. You know, there's some GC mass spec, and John's lab has some of that capabilities. Ours does not. And there's a possibility for assaying for, you know, acceptable levels or creating a spec in our breweries. But I mean, really, a lot of this is just done through practice. A lot, again, going back to the survey that I did, most brewers were between 0.4 and 1 pound, or essentially a half a pound to a pound per barrel on their pellet dry hopping amounts.
And does that vary with the alpha acid percentage? Or?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I'd have to say in my own experience, some of the varieties like Simcoe are pretty pungent, and there's a little more carryover at lower volumes, but it seemed to be numbers that people were comfortable with both high and low alpha hops. Now, if you were to take all these beers and line them up, I mean, that's really what needs to be done next is some analytical on this and some, you know, and come with some points and numbers. You know, everything else is a bit subjective.
I mean, and my first brewing job was in Boston at a place called Commonwealth, and you know, we made cask conditioned real ale. Unfiltered, fined, served warm down the street from the Boston Garden where the Bruins and the Celtics play. This was 1987. We were dry hopping beers then, and it was, you know, I should have been wearing, you know, antlers on my head, and people would have looked at me more straight than when they came in and asked for a bud. That being said, you know, we were making beers back then. We were dry hopping them quarter pound per British barrel. Now, British barrel's about 43 or something like this U.S. gallons. So we're talking, you know, 1 ounce per 10 gallons, half ounce per 5 gallon batch. Very low level. And you would pick it up on these light, you know, it's a light British bitter, you know, probably 1040 in there. And you would pick up a little bit of it. You know, at this point, we're also, you know, with the I think, you know, the half to 1 pound per U.S. barrel, so that's, what, 5 ounces per 5 gallon batch, right? So there's a really wide range there in terms of how much people are adding.
People are accepting more dry hop character in their beers, and now with the double IPA and soon to be probably recognized triple IPA style, I mean, it gets to a point of, you know, some people would say being obnoxious, but back to what you were doing originally, when you go to the UK and you taste some of these, you know, beers, what we're modeling our beers off of, there's a level of subtlety there that you really do have to appreciate. So, you know, back to the original question, there's no right or wrong answer. I think each individual brewer and consumer makes up their mind on what they like. I mean, I kind of fancy some of these products that are very lightly dry hopped, and when you taste them, you don't necessarily, it doesn't taste like a dry hop beer, but it added some element of complexity that wouldn't be there if it hadn't been utilized. So that's also important.
Do you do, Matt, let me ask you this. Do you guys, I mean, you know, I in general, when we're writing formulation, I will specify, you know, X pounds per barrel. And I don't know if you guys, if you do any variation. I personally do not. I feel like, you know, we settle on a varietal. The varietal is going to be relatively stable from year to year. The alpha acids may fluctuate somewhat, but really what I'm looking for is, I'm not picking up any alpha acids in it. I'm looking at oils.
Mm-hmm. Right, and when we go to selection, too, we're all about the aroma of those hops. I mean, yep. Throw whatever the alpha number might be out the window, because we're looking straight at, does it smell right to us, and is it pungent, and is it going to work well as a dry hop? Now, over the course of the year, on our IPA especially, we do tend to increase our dry hopping levels over the course of the year, because we do seem to see a little bit of fading towards the end of the harvest year. That's more recently. It's not all the time, and some of that is just, you know, through our panel, if we're starting to say that things are fading a little bit, we might add more. But most of the time, it's, yeah, we write the recipe, pounds per barrel, and that's what we stick to.
So it sounds like it's really subjective at this point.
I think it is, yeah. I think until somebody comes up with an analytical method, it's going to be the brewmaster said, and that's what we're doing, and then we'll taste it and make sure it's right.
Well, I think, you know, the other thing that I find that, you know, there's a real additive effect that I notice, with, especially with in dry hopping in these beers, because, you know, it would be great if we were dry hopping a glass of water and, you know, the same water with the same mineral content, and that was that. But we're not. We're dry hopping a, you know, sort of a moving target, and that moving target has got malt character in it. That moving target certainly has, you know, we as a brewery are very interested in fermentation characteristics. And so our ester package, you know, the esters, you know, I sort of think of these fruity characters, and they get sort of almost this juiciness with the hop, and they blend together, and it's hard to tell where one's finishing and the other's starting. I do think that we would have a significantly different beer, and people would probably ascribe that to dry hop. You know, you must change something on dry hop if our sort of the fermentation characteristics, our esters, our higher alcohols changed significantly, or even a little bit.
Absolutely, I agree with that completely.
So one final shot for the homebrewers. What do you think is either a short list or your number one strategy for getting that wonderful dry hopped character that we get out of your beers?
Keep it really simple. Dry hopping, like we've been saying, on the warm side, just towards the end of the primary fermentation, when we're still at warm temperatures. I'm a little different than John in that I go for shorter contact times. I'm looking for pure oil characteristic, and I'm trying to stay away from the vegetative characteristic. I'd rather use more hop for a shorter contact time than less hop for a longer contact time. But I think John pointed to something that's even more important up front, is if you don't have a clean beer up front, if you don't have a good fermentation up front, you know, if you haven't crossed your T's and dotted your I's before you did the dry hop, that dry hop is just going to combine with those muddled characters to create something that's not pleasing. So, you know, we tend to dry hop, the recipes that we're dry hopping, going back to the malt bill, are very simple, straightforward recipes, well-attenuated beers that will showcase that dry hop aroma. You know, we're not competing with big malt bomb recipes or formulations. And that's been a key to our pale ale success, I think, if you look at it on paper, it is the simplest malt bill, a low starting OG, and a very, you know, it's a very dry finishing beer, and the dry hop aroma and flavor just comes off of that very simple palate really nice.
I'd say for me, the critical thing there is just making sure you have, you know, super fresh, you know, the sort of well-handled hops. They don't need to be fresh, you know, in age, but they do need to have a very fresh character to them. So that means they need to have been well-handled. Can't, you know, those oxidized, cheesy aromas will just ruin that. You know, so much of what we're looking for, the really high notes, those really great volatiles that are going to get carried up. And unfortunately, those volatiles are also the ones that are going to be carried away very quickly.
Yeah, I agree with that entirely. It's like crap in equals crap out. You need to have good, fresh raw materials across the board. And exactly, that's a key. Selection is a key.
I mean, I think that, you know, with great brewing, you know, especially I sort of think in some of the great brewing traditions, that in many ways the brewer becomes transparent and the quality of that raw material just comes out. I would much rather have like a perfectly ripe, simple avocado than some overly complex sauce that was made from second-rate ingredients and too much spices. I mean, I'm about making it as simple as possible and just as fresh and beautiful.
Great. It's been an amazing conversation. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're pretty smart, Matt.
Yeah, John, you ain't so bad yourself.
Well, I want to thank Matt Brindelson and John Mallett again for taking the time to talk to us. I put their advice to work yesterday when I dry-hopped my Harvest Ale with my homegrown Cascade hops. So we'll see how that works out. Next week, I hope to have an interview with Chris Colby of BYL Magazine on strategies for brewing with extracts. It's been a while since we visited extract brewing in any depth, so I'm looking forward to that, and it'll be good to talk to Chris again. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say hey, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. While you're on our site, you can check out our online shop, where you can find great pricing on our DVDs in a combo deal to save you even more. In our first DVD, Basic Brewing Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, we walk you through the extract brewing process step by step from boiling to bottling. And in Basic Brewing Stepping into All Grain, we take you through the all grain process from milling your grain to collecting your wort. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it from us online, and we'll send it to you ourselves. Well, that's all until next week. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time. So long.